Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host, and our guest Jim Blackburn here with us to continue with Ask Me Anything about the Catholic Faith. If you have questions about the Catholic Faith, and listen, if you're not Catholic, if you don't know anything about the Catholic Faith, you just got something you want to know, you're welcome. We like talking about this stuff, and so do not feel at all unwelcome. Feel welcome. 888-318-7884, 888-318-7884 is the number. And the Catholic faith has got a lot of parts in it. Maybe you want to know about Jesus. Maybe you want to know about the Bible. Maybe you want to know about the Trinity. Maybe you got a moral or philosophical question. Whatever it is, you are welcome to ask Jim Blackburn. He's been doing this for a long time, and he is ready to take your questions. As a matter of fact, Jim is the founder of an apostolate called CatholicQuestions.com. Well, Catholic Questions, but you find them at CatholicQuestions.com. You can also get their app wherever you get your apps. Just head on down to the app store and pick up a couple of them. Pick up a couple of those apps. I don't know. Get a half dozen. They're free, I think. Jim Blackburn, thanks for being here with us.
Those apps are free. In fact, you can get one for your iPhone, one for your iPad, one for your Android, one for, you know, your Samsung phone. They're available.
Your BlackBerry?
Do they
still have BlackBerries?
I don't think they still have BlackBerry. Did they have BlackBerry apps? I don't know. It's been a long time since I've had one of those. But yeah, lots of ways to access Catholic Questions. Of course, the website, CatholicQuestions.com. You can, on our website, submit a question, and one of eight of us will respond. I still do most of the questions myself. I mean, I do more than other apologists, but the other apologists, we're all volunteers, and the other apologists are extremely helpful. And they're all well-vetted individuals, and they give great answers, just like an apologist at Catholic Answers would do. So feel free to contact us any way that you prefer, on the website or on an app, or you can always write us a letter or give us a call. We're available to answer questions.
Or you can call here at 888-318-7884, although all the lines are full at the moment. I know some people are probably like, wait, well, why aren't they competitors to one another? I'll tell you what Chris Check, our boss, says. We don't have any competitors. We have fellow laborers in the vineyard. That's what we have. And that really is the policy here at Catholic Answers. I know that's your policy. Jim, anything we can do to help people come closer to Jesus and his church, let's do that.
That's right. And a lot of, when we answer questions, the main thing we do is we try to really get to the heart of what the person is asking, and we answer that question. We try not to go off on tangents too much. And then we provide documentation, why we're providing our answer, you know, church documents, catechism, church fathers, church councils, whatever. We try to provide some documentation for that, with then some materials, follow-up materials, links, book recommendations, those kinds of things to help people explore it further if they'd like to. But we use a lot of Catholic Answers resources when we're answering questions. And the Catholic Answers and the Catholic Answers website, Catholic.com, still is just the go-to place for answers to questions about the faith. And but a lot of people want to talk to somebody, want to communicate someone to help, you know, make sure they're getting the right answer. And that's what we're here for.
888-318-7884 is the number. I know you're going to the big Eucharistic Congress, so I'm going to ask you about that. But I would ask if you can take it. We'll do a call first, because we actually have a gentleman on the line, Jackson in Frisco, Texas, who I think waited through the whole hour, the last hour. I am not sure, but it was a long wait. So can we do that? And then we'll talk about the Eucharistic Congress?
Absolutely.
All right, Jackson in Frisco, Texas, watching on YouTube. Thank you so much for your patience. Go ahead with your question for Jim Blackburn.
Hey guys, thanks for taking my call.
Hi, Jesse.
My question is a little broad, but I'll try my best to get to it succinctly. So I was raised Protestant, but I joined the church last year. Praise be to God. And I was always told, of course, I was told that, you know, anything bad in the world, you know, animal death, you know, the fact that the universe is going to have an end, that type of thing, was a result of the fall and a result of sin. And so I had continued to assume that until I started thinking about the question a little more deeply, I guess. And, you know, when you look at the sort of scientific facts that, you know, the universe has kind of appears to always have an end in sight and that sort of stuff, including, you know, the death before the fall and all that type of stuff. Like, so my question is, was the universe always supposed to be, you know, temporary? And if so, how do we accredit, you know, stuff that we perceive to be, you know, evil, like animal death, animal suffering, and, you know, the death of stuff like the sun and all that as coming from God? I hope that makes sense. Sorry.
Okay. It does make sense. And I think what this question hinges on is when God created Adam and Eve, if maybe he had not intended the universe to ever end, or maybe I should say if they had not sinned, it would seem that an end to the universe might be unjust. And we know God, of course, is just, is ultimate justice. And I think the way we can help make sense of the fact that the scientific evidence seems to point to the fact that the universe had a beginning, and it was created, and it was expanding, and it appears that things are going to end at some point. And so how do we reconcile the two? Well, God is outside of time, outside of the universe, in the sense that he created time and he created all that there is. And he knew, God he knows everything as though it's happening right now, from the beginning of time to the end of time. So it would seem that God did plan for time to end. We know that Jesus mentions that the world will end. We do also know that there will be a new creation at the end of time, or after the end of time. There will be a new heavens and a new earth, and so God will continue in the creativity process. So I would say, and I don't know that I can point to a church document that explains this, but it seems to me that, you know, because of God's omnipotence and his omnipresence, and the fact that he knows all that there is, being outside of time, that he knew that the world would need to come to an end, that time would need to come to an end at some point. So it would seem to me that that was God's intention all along. He knew Adam and Eve would sin. He knew that human nature would fall. He knew that he would need to send his son to save us. So all of these things, knowing that God is outside of time, in an eternal now, all parts of time are an eternal now to God, it would make sense to me that, knowing this, God did create the world, the universe, with a beginning and an intended end from the very beginning. Does that help, Jackson?
Oh, you know what? Hang on. Jackson, I put you on hold. I apologize. Go ahead. Did that help you?
You're okay. Yes, sir. Yes, that was very helpful. I would just one more part I'd like to understand a little more is, how do we say, you know, how do we accredit stuff like, you know, sort of the violence and brutality we can observe in nature on the animal level and stuff like that? How do we accredit that to God, especially under the, you know, the classical theism definition of God, where he's the fullness of being and all good, and so by definition, you know, can't, at least to my understanding, can't be the source of like a privation of that. So I guess just how would we maybe explain that part, if that makes sense?
Yeah, I think it does. And we have to really distinguish between two different types of evil. There are moral evils, and those are evils that we commit, evils that, you know, we choose to do something we know we're not supposed to do, and we cause harm in the world, in the universe, in the church. But then there are also natural evils, and it seems that God did create the universe in the animal kingdom, the plant kingdom, all that is living, with the idea that, that there would be what we might call natural evils, such as death among animals, death of plants. Some people want to say that Adam and Eve could only eat plants in the beginning. Well, those plants had to die for them to eat them. Is that an evil? Well, it's not a moral evil. Is it a natural evil? Well, maybe it's an intended end for God's creation. If we understand that God created everything, and the pinnacle of his creation is humanity, he created everything for us and for our ultimate end, which is union with him forever, eternally in heaven. So the natural types of evils do not necessarily come from original sin, or that we don't have to conclude that every natural evil is a result of original sin. Certainly, moral evil is a result of natural sin, and our inclination, our concupiscence, inclination towards evil, towards things that we know we shouldn't do, things that are offensive to God, that is a result of the fall. But to say that every natural evil is a result of the fall isn't a dogmatic teaching of the church. I guess I would leave it that way, Jackson.
Jackson, and I'm going to leave it there as well, because we have to take a quick break. Right back with more Ask Me Anything with Jim Blackburn on Catholic Answers Live.
Your questions, Catholic Answers Live. Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects homebuyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
Carry the faith wherever you go. Catch up with the latest news from Washington, D.C., the Vatican, and the world on all of our EWTN news platforms, including EWTN Pro-Life Weekly, the Catholic News Agency, and EWTN News In Depth. Download the EWTN app at EWTNapps.com today.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I am Cy Kellett, your host. So happy to be back. We had a great time with all the people who came with us on the pilgrimage to see the saints and the trees and the water and the people of Canada. We had a great, great time doing that. But now we're back resting up and having fun. And Jim Blackburn's here with us to answer any question you've got about the Catholic faith. 888-318-7884 is the number. 888-318-7884. Are you going to the Eucharistic Congress in Indianapolis next week? Catholic Answers will be there, and we want to see you. Stop by and say hi. You'll find us at book number 1239, 1239 in the exhibit hall. Meet Trent and Joe, get books signed, and spend some time with members of the Catholic Answers family. Also, Jim Blackburn's going to be there with Catholic Questions and his crew. Do you know, are you looking it up right now to see what booth you're going to be in? Because I gave
11,
the number.
Yeah, 1147.
Wait, that's almost 100 better than us. We're 1239 and you're 1147. How did you get 90? I think that's 92. I don't know. Like, how did you get about 92 spots ahead of us?
You know, I was looking. I've got a map here that I received from them. And I'm just around the corner from you guys.
Really?
But it looks like you've got you're kind of an end unit.
Yes.
Yeah, with all right. Booths going back behind you on both sides. And I'm like one of those little booths Catholic Questions is that goes down the sides.
That makes me
feel
better.
Like I'm not far from you.
I was going to write a strongly worded letter, but all right. Well, that makes me happy that we'll be on the end. Okay, so you can, in a matter of mere moments, visit Catholic Answers and Catholic Questions. What are you going to be doing there? Like, what kind of stuff will you do? Just meet and greet people, share the app so that people will download it? What else?
The main thing we're there for is exposure. So people know that we exist. You know, we have some brochures we're gonna hand out. We're a a tiny little apostolate. We're all volunteers, so we don't have a huge budget for this. We don't have a lot of giveaways, but we've got a few nice things. People stop by our booth, and we want to meet people. We want people to meet us and know that we're here to answer their questions, not necessarily at the conference, although we'll be happy to do that too if the need arises. But we just want to know people, have people know that we are out there and we're available. Several apologists from Catholic Questions will be there. I'll be there pretty much all day, every day. And then I know Jeremy's going to be there some. Chris is going to be there. We have, there are several of us. So stop by and meet us. And will Catholic Answers be selling 20 Answers books at the conference?
Okay. We will. Yeah.
So if anybody wants to pick up copies of any of my books, I've written 5 of them for the 20 Answers series, I'll be happy to come over to the Catholic Answers booth and sign it for you if you want.
Or no, just buy it again. And come around the corner and say to Jim, I bought your book here. You can sign it.
Absolutely.
And for a small fee, what do you charge people to sign their books? What do you charge?
I just ask for prayers in return.
That's beautiful. All right. Well, how about we go back to some phones? We'll do some phones.
Okay, let's go.
All right. Jamie's in Boston, Massachusetts, listening on Catholic.com. Jamie, welcome. Go ahead with your question for Jim Blackburn.
Hi. My question is, what does it mean that Jesus is the firstborn of all creation?
Okay, that comes to us. St. Paul writes that in 1 Corinthians chapter 1, verse 15. And he says of Jesus, he is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn of all creation. He goes on to say, for in him all things were created, in heaven and on earth, visible and invisible. And it goes on from there. And just before that, in verse 14, he's the beloved Son of God. So what St. Paul is saying here is the firstborn of all creation is somewhat of an idiom, because we know Jesus wasn't created. We know God wasn't, or the second person of the Trinity, the Son, was not created, but he was begotten. We say that in the Creed, begotten of the Father before all ages. And this is an indication that Jesus is, and Paul's using terminology here, firstborn in ancient Israel, and even in the first century, the firstborn had a special place in the family. The firstborn son had a special place when it came to inheritance, a special place when it came to taking over for the father, if we know when the father died, the human father. A very prominent place in the family. And Paul is expressing here that Jesus, as the Son of God, has a very prominent place in all of creation. He is the heir to all creation. He is the Son of God, but he's eternally the Son of God. So this firstborn is a very had a lot of meaning for first century Christians and the Jews in the first century, and so they would have known, you know, better than a reader who picks this up today might try to read too much into it. It's this firstborn is telling us about Jesus' place in all of creation. He is the heir to it. He is he is God himself, eternally begotten, eternally born of the Father. So that's what Paul's getting at there. It's Jesus is that important in the history of all of creation. Okay?
Gotcha. Okay, thank you.
All right, Jamie.
Okay,
thank you very much for the call. The number is 888-318-7884. You can ask anything you want about the Catholic faith. Jim Blackburn, our guest. And now we go to Orlando, Florida, where Andrew is listening on Catholic.com. Andrew, welcome. Go ahead with your question for Jim.
Hi, yes. So I'm a Protestant, but I'm learning more about the Catholic faith. And I've been looking into some things that differ. And one of them was women can't serve in the clergy in the Catholic Church. They can't be, they can't give the Eucharist and things like that. So I was wondering what exactly does a woman lack that a man has, that a man should do those roles and a woman cannot do those roles? Because, you know, you meet plenty of good women, you know, Mary, great woman, and we meet plenty of bad men. So I'm sort of wondering, what are those traits that are inherent to men, or what are the traits that women lack for those roles?
Watch yourself, Blackburn, on how you answer this.
This might sound a little facetious, but what they lack is manhood. They are not men. They're not male. And Jesus ordained only men to the ministerial priesthood when he was here. And the apostles went on with the understanding that only they had the ability to do what Jesus did, and that is ordain other men to the priesthood, to the episcopacy, and so on. This is the way that that it was done from the beginning. Now, we could ask Jesus in heaven someday what all his reasons were for that, but we do know that men and women are different. And in the first century, this was much more pronounced than in today's age of women's liberation, what a lot of people want to think. But men and women are distinctly different. They have different roles in life. You know, we might ask Jamie. It's Andrew. Okay. You know, I might ask you, why can women be mothers, but men cannot?
And Andrew, I had you on hold when he asked you the question, so I apologize. So why can women be mothers and men cannot?
Well, obviously, it's a trait of a woman that they can be mothers. I understand they are distinct, but we obviously see why women have to be mothers, because they have, you know, the organs that make them that. So we know what in a woman makes them a mother. But I'm sort of like, the question I'm sort of asking is like, what's in a man that makes him worthy of priesthood? I understand that, you know, in the early church, men were typically the leaders of the church, and that's, you know, that's just history, you know?
Right.
So I'm more wondering what's in there that makes them.
Okay, you would agree that Jesus was a man. He was male.
Oh,
I'm sure you would agree with that. When the priesthood, the ministerial priesthood, when Jesus gave he instituted all of the sacraments, and when he instituted the sacraments, he gave the ministerial priesthood the ability and the obligation to administer the sacraments. And when they do that, they act in the person of Jesus. We say in persona Christi. Now, we wouldn't have a woman, it wouldn't be appropriate to have a woman act in the person of Jesus. Woman is female, Jesus is a man. I mean, that's just one of the little pieces of this that the church explains in a document from Pope St. John Paul II called Ordinatio Sacerdotalis. And that's a document from, back when Pope John Paul II was reigning, where he explains that the church, that Jesus did not give the authority or the ability to the church of ordaining women. And then he explains some of those reasons. And one of the reasons is the priesthood acts in the person of Christ, in the person of Jesus. And Jesus was a man. But the bottom line is Jesus just didn't give that authority to the church. Now, does that mean women are somehow second-class citizens? Or no, absolutely not. Our same Pope, St. John Paul II, wrote a document on women in the church where he expresses all of the things that they can do. Just because they can't be priests, they cannot receive holy orders, they can still act in ministry in other ways. Yes, you are correct. They cannot consecrate the Eucharist. They cannot hear confessions and offer absolution. They cannot administer the sacraments, although they can administer the sacrament of baptism. It's also possible for women to administer, so to speak, the sacrament of matrimony. Women can also experience the sacrament of matrimony and receive all of the sacraments. So this wasn't a slight to women in any way. Women are mothers, they're wives. Those are special roles in human history and in salvation history. Mary is the greatest of all human persons of all time. And she's not a man, she's a woman. Yet Jesus did not ordain her to the priesthood, to the ministerial priesthood. So I'd encourage you, Andrew, to go to Catholic.com and do a search for ordination of men or of the male-only priesthood. There's a great tract on the male-only priesthood where a lot of this has gone into. And then if you get a chance, look up that document, Ordinatio Sacerdotalis. That's Latin. If you need help spelling it, let the call screener know and we'll get the spelling for you.
Andrew, thanks. That brings us right up to the break. We'll be right back with more Ask Me Anything about the Catholic faith with Jim Blackburn. What was the church like in its infancy? In a word, Catholic. And Joe Heschmeyer has the receipts. In his best-selling book, The Early Church Was the Catholic Church, he gives you the details from the historical records of the first two centuries of Christianity. Right now, get a copy for just $10, plus free shipping if you live in the continental United States. Get more information and order The Early Church Was the Catholic Church at theearlychurchwascatholic.com.
When the resurrected Jesus appeared to disciples on the road to Emmaus, they didn't recognize him until the breaking of the bread. The same is true today. In the Holy Eucharist, we really meet Jesus. In The Eucharist is Really Jesus, author Joe Heschmeyer explains how knowing Jesus in the Eucharist is the key to understanding all of Christian faith. Order your copy of The Eucharist is Really Jesus today at shop.catholic.com or get it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Are you scared to talk about abortion? Don't worry, almost everyone is. You can overcome this fear as Trent Horn shows in the newly revised and expanded second edition of Persuasive Pro-Life. With a little knowledge and a few proven techniques, you can become a bold and effective apologist for life. Visit shop.catholic.com to order your copy of Persuasive Pro-Life and never again be afraid to speak up. Also available at good Catholic bookstores.
Is Orthodoxy an alternative to the Catholic Church? In a time of uncertainty for many Catholics, Orthodoxy can look like greener pastures. Answering Orthodoxy, the new book from Catholic Answers Press, explains why Catholics who are thinking of leaving need to think twice. There are important reasons to remain in the Catholic Church and convincing answers to Orthodox claims. Order your copy of Answering Orthodoxy today at shop.catholic.com or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Matt Swaim here. Join us for the Best of the Sunrise Morning Show with summer reading suggestions, pilgrimage ideas, and tips for incorporating your faith into summer activities. Now back to Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. The Early Church Was the Catholic Church. That's Joe Heschmeyer's very fine book. Just $10 plus free shipping within the United States. How much do you know about the beginnings of the Catholic Church? Catholic Answers has your numero uno resource to learn. Pick this fantastic resource up at shop.catholic.com. The Early Church Was the Catholic Church. And we got the receipts. That's available for just $10 free shipping at shop.catholic.com. Jim Blackburn is our guest. Ask Me Anything. Chris is in Maryland watching on the YouTubes. Hello, Chris. Go ahead with your question.
Hi, Si. Hi, Jim.
Hi, Chris.
Si, I just wanted to say thank you to you and Joe and Chris Check and Father Keller. I was in Charlottetown last Tuesday, and I had the opportunity to speak with the four of you after Mass at St. Duncan's.
Oh, yeah.
Basilica. So I appreciate the opportunity to speak with the four of you here. And get to meet you in person here and take a photo. So thank you very much.
I remember it very well, Chris. That was very, very nice to get to chat with you in the middle of the church there till we all got kicked out. But thank you.
Yes.
Thanks for visiting with us. So you're back home now.
Yeah, I'm back home now just like you are here. So great to meet the four of you here. So thank you very much and God bless you. Thank you. I appreciate it.
Yeah. All right. Well, go ahead and give Jim your question.
Hey, Jim. Two questions tied to the Mass. As I was in Canada last week, as you heard, I noticed at Mass here that from the consecration, once the consecration is done to the great Amen, that the lay people actually stand once the consecration is done here. However, in the United States, we kneel from the Holy Holy to the great Amen. And I was wondering, I guess, why the U.S. bishops requested permission to do this, and are there any other requests that the U.S. bishops asked for that make it different than other parts of the world that celebrate the Mass? Thank you.
Okay. Yep. That is kind of a broad question, but the general instruction of the Roman Missal is what is the basis for where these instructions come from. And the general instruction is a universal document for the Latin Rite, or ordinary form of the Latin Rite of the Mass. And it's intended to be followed, you know, worldwide. However, there are parts of it where local bishops' conferences have the ability to make changes or to modify things that maybe makes more sense for their culture, for their what their people are used to, maybe. And the as far as sitting, standing, kneeling, we find all of these instructions in the general instruction of the Roman Missal. In the United States, we kneel, you know, after the Sanctus, we kneel, and then we kneel for the entirety of the Eucharistic prayer. We stand, and then we kneel again, right before communion. Coming back after communion, the bishops throughout the world can decide whether the faithful kneel or sit or give the faithful their choice of what to do at that point. So that's how the general section of the Roman Missal reads. Now, what specifically are you seeing different in the United States? Does it have to do with when we come back from communion, or when we kneel after the Sanctus, or can you repeat that part of the question?
Sure. No problem. So I noticed that after the consecration is done, when they sing the Eucharistic acclamation there, they stand after the consecration of the host and the body and the blood of Christ here, and they stand to the great Amen. We kneel from the Holy Holy all the way through the Eucharistic prayer to the great Amen, and then we stand for the Our Father here. So I did some research. It said that, I guess, U.S. bishops have, as you said, permission to be able to do that. What sort of made them decide that we should kneel through the whole Eucharistic prayer? Is it just for just because it's one prayer specifically here? Is there a particular reason why we do that, particularly compared to the other parts of the church in the world? And I guess what flexibility do bishops actually have, I guess, to be able to make these types of changes here to the Mass here, overall, just generally speaking?
Okay. The general instruction of the Roman Missal, I guess bishops' conferences can contact the Vatican, the Congregation for the or the Dicastery for the Discipline of the Sacraments, and make requests, and those will be approved. But there are also parts of the general instruction itself that allow for modifications to be made, you know, by the bishops or even by the faithful. When we, like I say, after we receive communion, you know, we can sit or kneel if we choose to, whichever we choose to. But why the bishops of the United States, my understanding is the general instruction, it does state that we kneel until the great Amen. And if there's some place that is standing, you said, I think, after the consecration, immediately after the consecration, they're standing at that point. I've not seen that happen anywhere.
I did. I saw that in Canada. The Canadians do that. And I have to say, I was like a sheep just following along, and then I stood up, and then I looked around, and all the Americans are still kneeling. And then I pretended like I had that I had to scratch my knee, and then I knelt back down because I felt so dumb just standing up just because I'm a sheep. But I know exactly what Chris is talking about. They just do it differently up there. They stand up well before the great Amen.
Yeah, so I don't know if that's something that the Conference of Bishops of Canada have requested, you know, for the entire conference, or if that's something that particularly the local bishop has done, or could it be that just the local pastor of that parish has done that? And if so, that's probably was done illicitly, because these instructions are to be followed for the sake of the universal conformity mm-hmm. of all the faithful. This is a corporate prayer. We're all in this together, and the uniformity is something that's important. But it could be that the bishops of Canada requested it to be done that way. I can't answer for them or for the Conference of Catholic Bishops in the United States if it was them who chose to do something different than, say, what Canada is doing. I'd have to do some research on that, Chris. I'm not even sure I could find the answer without actually contacting maybe the Conference of Bishops to research it. But the fact that there's uniformity is really what's most important, that we're all doing the same thing, you know, not standing up and scratching our knee or kneeling back down, scratching our knee.
I was just trying to look like I knew what I was doing. I just, because gotcha.
I understand.
Yeah.
The general instruction does indicate that this uniformity to show that we are the church and we're here together, we're worshiping together, is something that's very important to the Mass. So when the local bishop or the Conference of Bishops gives us an instruction, then we should be following that, and you know, for the sake of this uniformity and this corporate worship. It seems more appropriate to me to remain kneeling throughout the Eucharistic prayer. That's the only way I know it, really, but that's what seems to be most appropriate to me, because the Eucharistic prayer, the canon, this is the holiest prayer of the Church. This is where the Eucharistic, the consecration takes place. This is a huge prayer in the central focus of the Mass, and to kneel for the entirety of it, to me, is a joint show, a uniform show of reverence for what's happening during the Eucharistic prayer, and then we stand afterwards. So why someone would choose to, a bishop or a conference of bishops would choose to make a change to that, I don't know. I'd have to do some research on it. Okay, Chris, sorry I can be more help on that.
It was a great pleasure to meet you, Chris, and to share Mass with you there. But we got to take a quick break. So I'll tell you what, if you'd like a book, I'd like to send you. We've been talking about Joe's book, The Early Church Was the Catholic Church. I'd love to send it to you there in Maryland. Just hang on. Edgar will get an address, and we'll send you off a copy of Joe's book. We got to take a quick break. We'll be right back with more. Ask Me Anything About the Catholic Faith. With I just gave away Joe Heschmeyer's book with Jim Blackburn on Catholic Answers Live.
Hang on, Catholic Answers Live will return in a moment.
In Morse code, the sequence SOS is a distress call. It's been said that it stands for Save Our Souls. Well, right now our world is in big trouble, and we're putting out an SOS call for help. Will you answer that call? St. Paul Street Evangelization, a Catholic nonprofit, has hundreds of teams who share the good news with souls who don't know Jesus. Catholic Answers is supported in part by St. Paul Street Evangelization. Visit streetevangelization.com to get involved.
Hi, this is Mike Aquilino with a few words about St. Ignatius of Antioch. St. Ignatius was one of the first Christians to leave a body of written work. His seven letters are like windows into the life of early Christianity. They show us a church centered on the Eucharist, with the clergy of bishops, priests, and deacons looking to authority in Rome, worshiping Jesus as true God and true man. Sound familiar? Well, it should.
Welcome back, Catholic Answers Live. I think the primary lesson of the last call was, if you make a mistake at Mass, just act like you meant to do it because you were doing something else, and then just go on. Like, just try to save face. And that's the most important thing, save face when you make a mistake at Mass. Let's see. Oh, Jim Blackburn's our guest. I'm just trying to figure out who I'm going to next here, Jim. Let's go to Ryan in Illinois watching on YouTube. Ryan, go ahead with your question for Jim.
Hi, Ryan.
Hello. I have a question. I think it's 1 Samuel 16. It talks about God sending an evil spirit onto Saul. Does that mean like a demon or something like that? And kind of like the second part of that question is like, does God still like chastise people, whether physically or however, or like he did in the Old Testament today? That's my question.
Okay. Ryan, what we're seeing happening in the Old Testament is actually not maybe how it's explained. And let me explain that. In the Old Testament times, keep in mind humanity was at an earlier state of development, of understanding, of understanding God. And God had not fully revealed himself yet. And during much of the Old Testament times, people attributed everything to God. When something good happened, it was attributed to God. When something bad happened, they attributed it to God. And would use language like this, that, you know, God sent a demon, or God hardened Pharaoh's heart, or God, this type of language that was used attributed everything to God, because everything exists because of God, and everything exists for God. And if it happens, it's God's will. So God made it happen. Well, as humanity grew up and matured and received more revelation from God, we understand that even though that language was used, these are things we bring on ourselves. And if a person sins, does something evil, and let's say then something demonic happens in that person's life, it's not God doing it. We know that now. We know that God wills the salvation of everyone, and he gives everyone the grace that he needs to ultimately be in communion with God and to die in that state. So when we fall out of communion with God, we're doing that to ourselves. We don't attribute things to God in the same way that a humanity at a much more crude level of understanding expressed these ideas, these thoughts, these things that they see happening, just attributed everything to God in the sense that he wills it, or he forces it, makes it happen. God allows humanity to interact with each other and with him, and he allows, for the sake of our free will, the ability to love him, the ability to choose to love him, he allows these bad things to happen, but he doesn't cause them. We cause them ourselves. So this is, if you want to get a better understanding of how God's revelation has grown and developed, and our understanding of God and his interaction with humanity has grown and developed and changed over the course of salvation history, look up the term divine pedagogy, divine teaching. And there are books about it. There are lots of resources online where you can read about how God brought up humanity much the way a human father brings up his own children. You know, we treat our children differently when they're very young. We reveal different things to them when they're young than when they're teenagers or when they're adults. And the consequences of their actions, while, you know, we might, you know, spank a child as a consequence of his behavior, he eventually will know that he brought that on himself, that this was not a choice that the father was making and imposing this on the child in some mean or harsh way, but it was a way of bringing up that child in a way that was best for that child, and it bringing him into adulthood. And now with the coming of Christ and the fullness of God's revelation in Jesus, we have the maturity of humanity. And we know God and his revelation in its fullness now, what he wants us to know. And we know that God is just. He allows these things to happen. He doesn't, it's not his primary will or what he desires for us, but he allows bad things to happen for ultimately the sake of our good. Does that help, Chris? Or Ryan,
yes,
I'm sorry.
Yes, that helps. Thank you.
All right. Look that up, Divine Pedagogy. There are a lot of good articles out there that you can just find for free on the internet that make sure you look up Catholic Divine Pedagogy. And it's very interesting, and it makes a lot of sense.
Ryan, thanks very much for the call. On we go. Time is getting short now. So to another Chris, we spoke with Chris from Maryland before. This is Chris from Pennsylvania listening on the EWTN app. Awful glad you're here. Chris, go ahead with your question.
Good afternoon, Jim and Cy. Jim, I have a question concerning plenary indulgences. I understand that a plenary indulgence remit all of the temporal punishment that is due a person for sins already forgiven and can normally only be granted once in a day. Now, my question concerns an exception to that. I understand if a person gains a plenary indulgence during the course of a day and then dies later that day, can be granted another plenary indulgence known as an apostolic pardon, which does mm-hmm. the first thing as the first plenary indulgence. And can you explain to me how the earning second plenary indulgence or apostolic pardon is of benefit to that person who has already been granted a plenary indulgence earlier the same day?
Yeah, sure. And this is, to me, it would seem that, well, first of all, the apostolic blessing or the apostolic pardon that comes at the end of life is such a beautiful gift from the church, from God. To know that a person can, on his deathbed, receive, along with the sacraments, receive this plenary indulgence is a beautiful thing. I was talking to a priest one time who I was asking him about it, and he actually, for some reason, didn't even know about it. And so I helped him research it, and he was sure to start making that an active part of his ministry from then on. I would hope that on my deathbed, I have a priest who knows about that and offers that to me. But what can happen between if you receive a plenary indulgence, say, in the morning, and then at your death, you receive the apostolic pardon, you know, what can happen between the two? You know, we can, as you rightly defined, an indulgence, a plenary indulgence, is a remission of all of the temporal consequences of sins that have already been forgiven. Well, these temporal consequences of sins are not necessarily sins of themselves, but they're attachments to sin. And a person immediately after receiving an indulgement can immediately become attached to sin again. You know, have the concupiscence, our own concupiscence, our attraction to sin is something that can come back to us immediately. It's almost difficult to receive a plenary indulgence and know that you have that complete detachment from sin, which is required for a plenary indulgence, by the way, to know that you have that and you maintain that. So it's a final way of ensuring that this person has received the remission of hopefully all of the temporal consequences due to his sin and that attachment to sin at the point of death. Of course, if there is any attachment that remains, or if the apostolic pardon is granted when the person is not completely detached from all sin, even attraction to venial sin, then it would be something less than a plenary indulgence, and that cleansing would still need to come at a state after death, before entering heaven, of course, that we call purgatory. But it might limit that. It might drastically reduce the time needed for purgatory, if not eliminate it altogether.
I'm going to leave it there because we are getting near the end and there are still quite a few folks on the line. Chris, thank you very much for the call. Christine is in Indianapolis, Indiana, listening to EWTN on Channel 130, Sirius XM Satellite Radio. Christine, welcome. Go ahead with your question.
Thank you so much. Actually, this has been a question I've had for a very long time, kind of in the back of my head, and you brought it up when you mentioned a general confession.
Yes.
And I have I've always wondered what those are and why would one do it, because I thought that once you've confessed your sins and received the the remission of the sins, then that's it, and God puts in, I know there's a verse in the Bible where, you know, your sins are far away. And aren't we just digging up things that have already been confessed? And why would you do a general confession, basically?
Wonderful, Christine. Thank you.
Yeah, Christine, in the way that you're using the term, my understanding of general confession would be for someone who has been away from confession for a long period of time. And rather than go stand in line on a Saturday afternoon in the confession line and be in and out in a couple of minutes, this is a person who's going to need some time to sit down with the confessor and talk about things that have happened in some cases years or decades since his last confession. So a general confession in that sense is for someone who needs that extra amount of time than what would ordinarily be allotted in the confessional on a scheduled time for confession. So a general confession would be for someone who has been away from confession for a long time, essentially.
Christine?
But I thought that somebody mentioned, yes, thank you. I thought that you mentioned that even if you've confessed the sins to one of the other callers earlier on, you said even if you've already confessed the sins, it is good or okay to bring them up again later on.
Well, there
and
is.
And that's when you mentioned general confession.
Yeah, like, for example, there, Jim, there's the, not the policy, but the practice some people have. Like, for example, before a priest is ordained, or sometimes before someone gets married, or another big, they'll make a general confession where they'll review their life, their entire life, with the priest as a way, my understanding is, as a way of trying to fully detach themselves from whatever attachment they have to those past sins. And so it includes the particular confession of things that the person needs to confess at that confession, but it's much more of a review of the whole life as a practice of trying to go over it again in the presence of the priest to receive all the graces that are needed to be fully detached, you know, it, as not as a necessary preparation for a wedding or for an ordination, but as a kind of spiritual practice to be fully I suppose spiritually open to receive that those graces.
Yeah, and I can see how something like that might also give the confessor more insight into the history of the person and maybe be able to offer greater advice, more appropriate penance, those kinds of things. But if we're thinking that we need to confess sins that we've confessed before and have already been absolved in the sacrament, then that's not necessary. And in fact, I can see how that could lead to scrupulosity. We want to take a very cautious approach to recommending that someone do something like that. To me, that sounds more appropriate for spiritual direction than it does for confession. But so maybe what's happening here is it's a kind of a joint spiritual direction, confession, all at one time. And I can see how at very important points in a person's life he might choose to do that.
Christine, thank you. Let's give Christine our 20 Answers book on the sacraments. And if we have one particularly on confession, let's send her that one as well. I can't remember if we have a 20 Answers just on confession or not. But if Edgar, you can check and see and send it to Christine. Christine, thanks. Sorry to everybody we didn't get to, but what a wonderful problem to have. So many calls, so many questions. We'll do it again tomorrow. Jim Blackburn, you can find out, you can find his work at Catholic Questions. You can go to CatholicQuestions.com or just download their app. They even have a phone number where you can call them. Even they have a physical address. Jim Blackburn, thanks.